Welcome to Clarity Lab, where I talk to leading health and science experts to educate, inform, and dismantle misinformation. And if you are a human on this planet in 2025, you probably know what a problem misinformation is. I'm Derek Barris, and Clarity Lab is the official podcast of Cyrus Health, a 501c3 nonprofit I founded to build a free educational platform and curate social media channels that feature experts presenting health and science in a clear and compelling manner. And since we are a nonprofit, all your donations are tax deductible, which helps support our mission. Please visit cyrushealth.org to learn about what we're doing and what we plan to do in the future. And if you can support us, we would greatly appreciate it. Did you know that seed oils are toxic? How about tap water? Sunscreen is definitely toxic. Carrots? Toxic. 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 If you follow wellness influencers, you'd think we live in a toxic stew of modernity where every company and institution is out to get us. Thankfully, they have the detoxes that are going to save us all. So I wanted to talk to an actual toxicologist. And thankfully, Ryan Marino, MD, agreed to join me. We don't only discuss toxicity in the wellness industry, we also chat about his area of expertise, addiction, and the stigmas around it. Ryan Marino, MD, is a triple board certified medical doctor actively practicing medical toxicology, emergency medicine, and addiction medicine. He works at the University Hospital's Cleveland Medical Center and is an assistant professor in the departments of emergency medicine and psychiatry at Case Western Reserve University School of Medicine. I follow him on a bunch of social media handles, which I'll include in the show notes. He's a great person to follow. Enjoy. Ryan, this morning I received an email from Mark Hyman telling me that I could possibly sign up for his 10-day detox sort of reset into 2025 program. And he included a link to a questionnaire of about 70 questions, the type that you would find when you go to a doctor and, you know, do you experience insomnia, depression? Some of them were pretty intense to the point of you would need serious interventions if you were experiencing these things, which I found surprising, but not surprising given that it's a man who made $28 million selling supplements in 2023. After I finished the test, it told me that I was mildly toxic, or I was suffering from mild toxicity. You could also be moderate toxicity or severe toxicity. As a toxicologist, when you see this sort of response from somebody who is putting forth a medical questionnaire online, what goes through your head?
A lot of things go through my head. I mean, I think the main thing is just, it's really unfortunate because that is predatory. I mean, Mark Hyman is a very predatory individual. His livelihood and businesses kind of operate on that foundation, convincing people that there's something wrong with them and that he has the answer, the cure, the solution. In this case, I mean, a detox. And I think that is one thing that comes up a lot, is this idea of detoxing, this concept or belief in quote unquote toxins, and this idea that either our lives are just constantly being exposed to toxic substances, or even that our bodies are constantly making toxins. And that, I mean, goes back even thousands of years into recorded human history, this idea of auto-intoxication, that somehow our body is producing things that are poisoning us that we need to get out. And I mean, I think a good historical example is the concept of bloodletting, which sounds barbaric and silly and nonsensical today, but it's the exact same idea as what Mark Hyman is selling.
It's one of the reasons Samuel Hahnemann actually created homeopathy, was because of bloodletting, because he saw that happening. And I always found that interesting because what he ended up producing is non-effective, but the reason he did it was because he thought that things like bloodletting were barbaric. Toxic is such a common term in wellness spaces. I see it all the time. I'm sure you do as well. First, can you give me a 101 on what you do as a medical toxicologist?
Medical toxicology is the medical specialty that deals with the acutely poisoned patient. I would add that it involves more than that in terms of kind of chronic issues as well. But when it comes to defining what that means, that is where I think people don't necessarily know about my specialty, and there's not really very many of us. So that can be anything from someone who was bitten by a venomous snake and is experiencing symptoms from that and needs to be treated with antivenom, to someone who has been accidentally taking too much of their medication and it's built up in their body and they're experiencing adverse effects from that, to someone who overdosed, whether accidentally on street drugs or intentionally on Tylenol or something like that. Very broad range of things. And so trying to tease out what the pathophysiology is in terms of our exposure to potentially toxic substances.
And how did you become interested in that field? It's such a fascinating career choice.
I really like, organic chemistry and physiology. And so I like the way that toxicology is kind of like a more of a way of thinking than a way of doing things necessarily, because a lot of times the main thing that I do is telling people not to do things. That was kind of how I got interested in it. I was exposed to it pretty early on and heavily as well, which may have kind of colored my perception. I enjoy it. I think it helps you kind of understand. At least for me, I can think of everything in toxicologic terms.
One of the more common claims that I've seen, and I've actually known people who've said this, is that they're suffering from mold toxins in their home. Have you come across this? And if someone actually wanted to test for mold toxicity, what would you have to do? Because I've come across some pretty suspect sort of tests before, so I'd love to better understand what would be required to actually know if you had that condition.
This is a good question too, because it also illustrates a very general concept, and this idea that people experiencing symptoms, very easy to just attribute that to something that sounds easy to modify and plays into this desire for magical thinking. Everyone, of course, would love if a pill could fix everything, if just moving out of your house could fix everything negative that you're experiencing. Mold can certainly cause a wide range of health problems. And this is, I would say, probably, if not just a popular area in like the wellness and woo and pseudoscience space, but maybe growing in terms of attributing things to fungus and different molds and that kind of thing. The mold that grows in people's homes definitely can cause very serious health effects. If you are experiencing symptoms, should seek evaluation by a medical professional. I don't want to just kind of generalize here, but most of the time the mold that grows in a house causes symptoms where it's just irritating to people. And so people will believe that they are either being infected, that they have developed an allergy, many other things. People will sell them different products to try to treat those things. But really, it's just being around the mold is irritating. And so, people will feel better when they go to work. At the end of the day, it's not really causing any organ damage, any true harm to the person. It's just a big nuisance, which is not anything to sneeze at, but doesn't need a 28-day course of antibiotics from someone online, that kind of thing.
Another one that has become really big, it's always been around, but since RFK Jr. and the MAHA movement, is this idea that our food supply is just overly toxic. I recently published a piece that was showing that out of 113 measured nations, the U.S. lags in certain respects, but quality and safety were actually number 3 out of those developing nations, which I think is pretty important to recognize. But there's this real thrust in wellness space right now that everything we're eating is toxic. Have you come across this, and what are your feelings on this idea as compared to actual toxicity that is possible compared to the claims they're making?
I have definitely come across that, and it seems to also be kind of growing in mainstream popularity. This, again, kind of goes back to this idea that like toxins are out there. There are things that are trying to harm us in our everyday life. And it's very easy to fixate on something like red dye number 40, rather than actually the fact that we're eating too many calories as a nation, we don't get enough physical activity, we don't get quality sleep, all of these other things. And so not to say that the food we eat couldn't be better and that there aren't real concerns from things like ultra-processed foods and health effects, but it seems to be more of a kind of one-and-done fixating on things like individual ingredients. And oftentimes as well, people will ignore the fact that something like any amount of alcohol is a carcinogen and can cause many, many health effects without getting to cancer. I mean, things like cooked animal proteins are carcinogenic. For people to focus on just like the foo dye in Cinnamon Toast Crunch or something like that seems a little hypocritical to me, or some sort of like cognitive bias, inappropriate way of thinking about things, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And that's why the influencers I follow tell you to eat your meat raw so that you avoid the carcinogens. So your specialty is in addiction medicine. What are some common myths you've come across around addiction?
There are a lot of myths about addiction. I think some of the biggest ones would have to be addiction is like a personal choice or a moral failing, when in fact we've known for many decades now that addictions, and I mean particularly when it comes to like dependence on drugs or substances, can be treated medically, and even, I mean, without the addition of things like counseling and psychotherapy and stuff, people can have very good success in treatment of that just from medicine alone. That is one big area, and I think the other end of that is that when it comes to using medicine for treatment of addiction or helping people with things like trying to quit using substances, that kind of thing, people see the medicines or the medical therapies as like replacing one addiction with another, some sort of crutch or cheating, just kind of in a negative light, when the alternative, I mean, is usually, especially in the context of like the past decade or more with our overdose crisis in the United States, the alternative is like very high rates of people dying. And not just dying, but suffering a lot of harms along the way as well.
We have seen, I believe, this year, a turnaround in some of those numbers. Have you followed that? Like, what do you attribute that to?
It is definitely very encouraging that the overdoses declined, and declined significantly for the first time in quite a few years. But there is no single intervention that can directly be correlated to this. And so for me, I mean, I think this is years of work. There are a lot of grassroots harm reduction groups out there that are kind of doing the lion's share of the work day in and day out. And I think those kind of small pieces ramping up over time have probably made a much bigger difference. Whereas we want to attribute this to some sort of policy change, making Narcan be available over the counter now, when the actual data shows us that making Narcan available over the counter, well, I think that's great. I think that was the right thing to do. Did not actually really affect overdose deaths in any way, at least up to this point.
I almost lost two people close to me, one family member, one friend, to fentanyl. Thankfully, both have recovered, but I know you have a special interest in that. And how did that come about?
Well, so I think fentanyl, first of all, is a really good example of kind of going back to the initial question, where people think of like toxins in these black and white concrete terms, whereas real life is all shades of gray, and there's more nuance than I could ever ramble on for hours about. Fentanyl, I mean, kills 100,000 Americans a year, but it's also an invaluable medicine. And so, I mean, this is one of the most ubiquitously used, and I'm talking gotta be like in the top five most widely used medicines in the entire world, and not just for treatment of pain, but it is preferentially used because it has a great safety margin. When it's used medically, it's used very safely. There aren't big concerns. We don't have problems with people overdosing or dying from it. My kind of career, starting with my training in like the early 2010s in Western Pennsylvania, was very significantly colored by the opioid epidemic and the rise of fentanyl. I mean, I was seeing people in the emergency department in a 10-hour shift, sometimes two or three times, for overdoses within just a span of several hours. This affected friends, family members. I've lost a lot of people to fentanyl, but seeing kind of the harms from misinformation, one day at a hospital that I was working at, I came to see one of the patients who was there for complications related to IV fentanyl use from street drugs, and they had actually used in the hospital and overdosed in their room. And instead of getting resuscitated, this patient who was in a medical setting and experiencing an overdose, the staff was actually trying to seal off the room because they were worried about exposure to fentanyl. And so up until that point, that had been something that I had seen on the news and kind of laughed about. That definitely made it a lot less funny. I realized that there was a lot of harm from this kind of misinformation. And that is, I mean, just one of the myths related to like drugs and addiction.
I worked in an emergency room for 2 years as a patient monitor for suicidal patients, but when I wasn't monitoring someone, sometimes I would transport patients, or in the emergency room, as you know, can go from 0 to 100 in the blink of an eye. And one thing I remember was that there were recurring patients, meaning someone would be going into having some sort of bad effect and need to be in the emergency room from some substance. And then you would see him there again 2 weeks later, and it would happen over and over again. To your point about the idea that addiction is not a personal choice, there's a lot more going on. But one of the things I've appreciated about monitoring your work is you also talk about the stigma around addiction. How do you help patients overcome social perceptions when they're in recovery or they're trying to make sense of what's happening to them?
So it's really hard. I wish I had a good answer. I wish there was like a good strategy for doing that. Every individual case is going to be different. Every situation where stigma arises is going to be different. And everyone's kind of comfort in interacting in those situations is going to be different. But the most important thing that people can do, I mean, is just having conversations like this, talking about how people, you know, use fentanyl. And it isn't necessarily like a big deal. It's not something we need to whisper about or be scared to talk about. It's not something that I need to worry. I see people who use fentanyl every day. I shake their hand. I give them hugs. That, I think, is really the main like work to be done. But certainly in terms of treatment, I have to like fight with insurance companies regularly, patients getting taken off of their medications by our criminal justice system. A lot of aspects where stigma and bias is really problematic. It doesn't take anyone having to be like a health professional or anything to learn more about that kind of stuff, especially if people are coming into those different fields and spheres. That's probably the best way I can think of to deal with it.
I don't want this to get derailed by talking about healthcare insurance, because I have a lot of thoughts on that. It's actually been something I've focused on a lot lately. So last question, we're recording this on the day that Mark Zuckerberg announced that he's no longer going to have fact-checking at Meta, as if there was a lot anyway. But following you for a while on social media, really appreciating what you're doing and trying to combat misinformation, forward good information. How are you feeling right now about this sort of work online and trying to help people get access to good information compared to the flood of misinformation we have coming at us?
It can feel really discouraging, especially, I mean, seeing things Meta, not that I am active on Facebook or particularly care about that platform, but I mean, like Meta has many, many hundreds of millions, billions of people on its different platforms. That kind of information obviously makes an impact. And so it is concerning, I think, for like everyday people out there. I mean, in terms of everything else, every subject outside of like medicine is something I'm trying to learn. I want accurate information. And that's really discouraging to me, because it is hard to know where to look when the biggest sources of news and information in this country no longer care about actually responsibly fact-checking. And it seems like Meta is trying to follow in the footsteps of X and Elon Musk, where it actually was a great idea to try to have these crowdsourced corrective labels, but it has not worked out well. And I mean, that platform has devolved into a very veritable horror show, I think, of misinformation. And it seems like the incoming administration has maybe even made threats against fact-checking and calling things misinformation. It's kind of scary, but I think it gives more meaning and purpose that this stuff does matter. I mean, people do care. The fact that people are upset about Mark Zuckerberg saying this is actually very encouraging to me.
Okay.